I want to start this morning with a short midrash. Then Isaac asked the Eternal, King of the world, when you made the light, you said in your Torah that it was good. When you made the expanse of heaven and earth, you said in your Torah that they were good. And of every herb you made and every beast, you said that they were good. But when you made us in your image, you did not say to us in your Torah that humanity was good. Why, Lord? And God answered him, because you I have not yet perfected. Because through the Torah you are to perfect yourselves and to perfect the world, and all other things are completed. They cannot grow. But humankind is not complete. You have yet to grow. Then I will call you good. I love that little midrash because it talks to me, and I don't think I'm pushing this too hard, of the journey of change. Our lives are constant change, and that's built into humanity so that we may learn and we may grow. In the talkback session yesterday, it was a thought, it wasn't so much a question, came up about how really realistic is this notion of creating a perfect world, of using elbow grease to get there. And I told a little bit of a story that, it's not a story. It's from the Talmud. And that is the rabbis said that the Messiah would come under two conditions automatically. One condition was that if everybody in the world is good all at the same time, fat chance. The other, they said, was if everybody in the world was evil all at the same time. One of you goody-goodies ruins it for the rest of us. I mean, you come along and you do some random act of kindness and it's all over. But the third way is by paving the road to the Messiah. Now, I think that was in some ways the rabbi saying, don't hold your breath. This is not around the corner. In fact, it may never come. But what's important is not whether we get to the Messianic age, but the journey that takes us there. The journey itself has value because the journey itself transforms us and makes us look inside and reach outward to make things perhaps a little bit better. So I didn't want to leave the impression that I said yesterday, well, let's go out and do this, that, and the other thing, and the Messianic age is going to come, and there's going to be a perfect world, and two chickens in every pot, and four cars in every garage, and everybody hugging their neighbor without their neighbor's spouses getting upset. All of that may not happen so quickly, and it may not happen at all. But there is another rabbinic dictum that says, it is not incumbent upon you to finish the task, but neither may you desist from it altogether. So you may not finish the task, but you can't step back and wait for it to happen. Now, that's a whole aside from what I was going to talk about today, but it did come up yesterday, and I wanted to mention that. I'm still getting over the singing and dancing. I'll get there. Bah humbug. There are two other changes left over from exile that I didn't get to yesterday. And I think they're important ones. As you know, the Jewish community was in fact scattered throughout initially all of Europe. There wasn't a part of Europe that didn't have some vestige of a Jewish community in it. It may have been small, it may have been large, but they were there and they brought with them their traditions. And in the play Fiddler on the Roof, they had their traditions that carried them forward, and they had their prayer book that reminded them of the traditions that they were carrying forward, all these things. Some of these places were joyous and then cease to be joyous. And one of them that makes up the majority of Jews that ultimately came to America is the experience they had in Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe was an interesting kind of an exile because it was the largest Jewish community in the world. The largest Jewish community in the world came from Eastern Europe. The second was Germany, but the largest was Eastern Europe. And in Eastern Europe, the Jews ultimately were made to live in what they called the Pale of Russia, a section. They were confined. It was a ghetto. It wasn't the first ghetto. The first ghetto actually was established in Venice, in Italy. And the word ghetto comes from the Italian word ghetto, which means either a smeltering house or a gun foundry, a smelly, yucky place where the Jews were made to live. It was over the canal. Well, over the canal. They were all over the canal. But very isolated in that area, and Jews needed permission to leave the ghetto and to come back into the ghetto, and they were very controlled. But that concept of the ghetto continued forward in the exiled experience of the Jews. But in Russia, there was a second half of that. Because not only were we in exile, and not only were we isolated from the general society, but there were pogroms, there were dangers, there were attacks, there were rapes. It was not a pleasant place to live, but it was home. And I keep thinking of Fiddler, that movie or the play. Have most of you seen Fiddler? And yeah, good. All right, yeah, that's the universal guy running around with tzitzit hanging out of his pants and singing da 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 da. The one, I like Fiddler, incidentally, I really do. But the one problem I always had with it was the pogrom that came around the wedding time. Do you recall that? And it was kind of painted as a benign sort of a thing. You know, we have to do this. We don't want to really do this, but we have to do this. And that's not the way it was. It was truly miserable. And so three things happened during that period of time. There developed many Jews who found the answer that was going to be in communism. That was the answer. Everybody giving to one another, not having a class, not having a czar, just not having a czar, what was going to be an improvement over the life they had because so much of the oppression came from the czar. And so, you know, communism was a very attractive sort of a thing. And many of the early communists in Russia and in Eastern Europe were Jews who were trying to escape that establishment. The second thing that happened during this period of time was what we now refer to as modern Zionism. Until that period of time, there was always a yearning to return to the land. It was always there, but it was buried in liturgy, and nobody takes liturgy very seriously, okay? You know, dear God, return us to our land, knowing that that's not going to happen. You can pray for anything you want as long as you know it's not going to happen. And we do that all the time, incidentally. But it wasn't an active sort of an endeavor. It was the yearning. It was sitting at the rivers of Babylon, and there we weep. Babylon was now Europe, and it was Eastern Europe, and it was Poland, and it was Russia, and it was Germany. All these places that the Jews were living. But in Eastern Europe, they developed what we now know as modern Zionism or political Zionism. We're miserable. It's never going to get better. In France, the Dreyfus case took place where the military officer Dreyfus was charged with espionage and charged with spying and all sorts of things. And a tremendous rise in anti-Semitism took place in France. And Theodore Herzl, who was a German, actually a correspondent, a writer for newspapers, was in France covering the Dreyfus trial and realized that there could be no real freedom from the Jews in the galut, in the exile. It couldn't happen. And so to be able to be self-determination, have self-determination enter into the Jewish life, it had to be in our land. And so the endeavor to begin to try to return to that land began. And then there was a third thing that happened, an unbelievably huge migration to America. Now, the first migration of Jews to the Americas came with the Spanish. Lots of probably Muranos, but maybe openly Jewish people escaping the Inquisition in Spain came to the Americas. It is said to have included some of the people on even Christopher Columbus's ships. Perhaps their navigator might have been a Murano. Murano, for those of you who don't know the term, actually is a derogatory term for what they were officially called were conversos. Because in Spain, something very weird kind of happened. In Spain, the expulsion was of Jews, but if you weren't Jewish anymore, you didn't have to go. And so there were large numbers of conversos, people who converted to Christianity, many of them very sincerely, but some of them keeping their traditions in their homes and in basements and sneaking around, lighting Sabbath candles and doing all sorts of things. And ironically, those people still exist today. There are still Muranos today. Now, some of them are very ardent Christians. Some of them are very faithful Catholics, whose traditions include on Friday night we light candles. Why do we light candles? We don't know why we light candles, but we light candles. Coming out of that Murano experience, those traditions were established. And in Spain today, you know, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain was not lifted until the 1960s. Did you know that? I mean, there were Jews who returned to Spain before that, but it wasn't until King Philip returned to the throne of Spain that he formally lifted the expulsion of Jews from Spain. And you find very few Jews there. Very few. So that was the first migration. The second migration to America, and we're talking about exile because we're still in that mode of thought, the second migration came from the Germanic areas, Germany especially. Huge numbers of Jews came from the German territories. Now, these people were not escaping Germany. They were coming with Germans to find a new life in America. They were not in bad shape in Germany, but Germans came and Jews came with them, and they went all the way to the far west, Indianapolis, Cincinnati, if they had only known that the land of milk and honey was further west, although. With climate change taking place, we in Akron truly believe that we're going to have oceanfront property on either side. Just a matter of time. But in any case, they came and couldn't necessarily get jobs. There was still certainly a large amount of discrimination, and they couldn't enter the professions. So what did they do? They put packs on their back, and they started peddling goods from place to place, and that way they worked for themselves, and some of them were very successful, and they opened up little stores like Macy's and Gimbel's, Federated Department Stores in the Midwest came out of that period of time. And so they became rather successful and settled into a very happy America. Until the German experience, Jews never were considered, nor did they consider themselves residents of a country. Citizens. Residents they were. Citizens. There were always Jews living in Poland. There were Jews living in Russia. There were Jews living in France. There were Jews living in Spain. They weren't Spanish. They weren't Polish. They never identified as those kinds of things. Never in their mind that they were always the other. They were never given the rights of citizenship by the state. And that was just expected. They didn't try to fight for it. It's the way it was. We're Jews. We happen to be living here. We happen to be living there. In Germany, that began to change, you see, because in Germany, the Jews were given citizenship. They were citizens of Germany. They fought in the wars. They supported the country. And so there was this great complacency that set in. And as I say, they came to America in fair numbers, not because they were escaping, but because they were Germans. Eastern Europe is different. Eastern Europe, they came escaping. And that's the largest migration of Jews that came to the Americas came from Eastern Europe. They came in large numbers. They settled in New York. They set up their neighborhoods. They came to what they thought was going to be the Golden Medina is what they called it, the golden area, streets paved of gold, being able to make our way. And they found themselves in the tenements. It wasn't so wonderful, but there weren't pogroms. Okay, it wasn't that terrible. And they settled here. Now, I got to tell you, the German Jews were not happy about that because this was the riffraff. It was, you know, the German Jews had Macy's and Gimbel's, and now you got these people who were working in the garment district. And not only that, Reformed Jews came from Germany. They brought Reformed Judaism, and they built great temples. Temple Emmanuel in New York comes from that period of time. A tremendous, it's the cathedral of Reformed Judaism in the world today. Talk about not changing. They're still doing some of their service in German. Nobody understands it, but then nobody understands Hebrew anyhow, which is an important part of a rabbinic career. We have to understand that nobody understands what we're saying. In fact, one of my professors used to say that every rabbi has to have a phrase of Hebrew that he can effortlessly put into any conversation. It makes no difference what it means, but can effortlessly recite it. Mine was Kamaratzim Daisachama, you know. And so it says, Kamaratzim Daisachama, and you go on from there. Now, it means how many want hot cereal. Yeah, doesn't truly make any big difference what it means, right? But it's impressive because it's in Hebrew. I have a friend who chose the phrase from the Bible where Abraham tells his servant, place your hand under my thigh. But, you know, whatever. I didn't write it. It's there, okay? That was a way to take an oath. And believe me, people said, okay. So in any case, you need that. But these people were not that way. They spoke Yiddish. They didn't speak German. They didn't carry with them Reformed Judaism. It wasn't the cathedral. It wasn't the great choirs and everything. They were really kind of the riffraff. And the Germans gave them a relatively hard time when they came in. And so there was a movement in Judaism that started specifically to handle that exile. Not only were they exiled from Europe, but they were really exiled from the other Jews who were here in the Americas. And the Reform movement wasn't comfortable for them. They came as Orthodox Jews. They came with traditions of Orthodoxy, but they wanted to be American. They didn't want to not look like Americans and act like Americans and speak like Americans. They wanted to learn English. They wanted to be part of America. And so this tremendous kind of a tension existed. And they looked at the Reform movement and they said, it's gone too far. It's gone too far. I mean, men and women singing in the choir, that's okay. Men and women sitting together, that's okay. Eating a pork roast on Yom Kippur is not okay. You know, that's not good. And so they set out to conserve Judaism. And they came up with what is now known as the conservative movement. It looked Orthodox. It felt Orthodox. It prayed Orthodox. But it wasn't Orthodox. Men and women sat together. Kashrut was important, but if you didn't keep kosher, you weren't going to be tossed out or castigated. There were changes that were going to be made. Perhaps some of the service done in English, not very often, but some of the service done in English. All these things came to accommodate was the largest migration of Jews to the Americas. And then it stopped. It stopped in 1924. Because in 1924, the United States passed its Immigration Act. And immigration to America became based on the number of people already here from a country in Europe. And that's how the quotas were set out. If there were more people from England, lots of quotas from England. If there were more people from Germany, lots of quotas from Germany. When it came to Eastern Europe, it was only the Jews. There weren't all that many of them that had come over. And as a result, the quotas almost shut down entirely, the immigration of Jews from Eastern Europe. But they maintained in change. They invented a movement in change. They accommodated the change. They could be Jews, and they could be Americans, my God. They could be Americans. They could vote. They could own property. They could have businesses. Large amounts of anti-Semitism. Some trades were absolutely closed to the Jews during this period of time. Ironically, banking was one of them. But they didn't need that because they could open their own businesses. It was okay. We can make it happen. So what did they become if they didn't have business as teachers? Teachers were always needed, large numbers of teachers. New York Teachers Union was majority Jewish for a very long time. They become professionals, doctors, lawyers. You put a shingle on your door, you're in business. You didn't have to have somebody hire you and make your way in the work. And so they adjusted to that. Every Jewish parent wanted their child to be a doctor. I shared with some people, I think, at a meal that I was a great disappointment to my father. I really was. He never actually, and I'm being now somewhat serious, but he never actually forgave me for going into the rabbinate. It was probably my rebellion against him. But he really didn't care what I was. I mean, he was really very open to whatever I wanted to be as long as the letters MD followed my name. Be a gastroenterologist, be an internalist, whatever you want to be, as long as it's a doctor. And I think that that became kind of the mindset, if you will, of the Jewish community, because you could make it on your own. And now I want to go back to Europe for just a second. I'm going to end this section and get on to something perhaps a bit different. I want to go back to Germany. Because in Germany in the late 1930s, something happened that was unique in the history of Jews. Unique. Because until then, yeah, we were tossed out of some of the best countries in Europe. But if you became Christian, you could get away with it. The Inquisition had no power over Jews. It only had power over Christians. I mean, people don't realize that. The Inquisition and the expulsion were different things. Either you had to leave, but if you stayed as a Christian, you could stay. But the Inquisition came along and said, you're practicing Judaism quietly, we're going to burn you at the stake. But if you really converted, you could get away with it. But now in Germany, something different happened. It was almost a racial definition. No matter what you did, you were a Jew. If you had one grandparent that was a Jew, you were a Jew. And the destruction was so immense that the Jewish community couldn't believe that it was happening. They were Germans, for crying out loud. They were proud Germans. They had fought in the World War I. They were part and parcel of the fabric of society. They were teachers. They were lawyers. They were doctors. They were business people. They were in all of the trades. They were Germans. And now somebody came along and said, you're not. And not only that, we're going to become Judenrein. We're going to get rid of our Jews. And I've got to tell you that the changes that that brought, we have not recovered from today. Certainly, what had begun in Russia as political Zionism now came to the front. We're being slaughtered in Germany. We have no place in the world where we can consider ourselves safe. Even the Jews of America started to feel vulnerable. Very few of them moved, but vulnerable. And so the thrust to reestablish a Jewish state in the Middle East became now back burner to front burner. And of course, in the history, in 1947, the UN created that state. And incidentally, folks, it also created an Arab national homeland at the same time, which never came into being, which is a tragedy of history, but I don't want to spend a lot of time with that. So Zionism came forward to accommodate that change. And I think, as my daughter generally says to me, you know, Dad, every Jew has to keep a bag packed, because you never know when the next exile is going to come. So I think while Jews in America are freer than we have ever been before, in fact, I don't think people by and large make any distinction between Jews and Catholics and Protestants, and well, with UUs they make distinctions. So, you know, it's whole other ball game, as it were. But within that fabric, we have never been this secure in the history of Judaism, and yet there is a underlying gnawing feeling that it may not last. And then what? And so even the Jews of America, who I must say rarely move to Israel, okay, we're in love with America. We're not going to Israel very quickly. Some young people every now and then, and some old people every now and then, but not great numbers. Remain, however, probably committed to the concept that there has to be that Jewish state because it's the fallback. If everything else fails, it's the fallback. But the other change that the Holocaust brought, and incidentally, Holocausts still go on every day. Okay, every day, especially right now in Africa, but every day people are being slaughtered in great numbers. The difference is just as, well, it's not a difference. In Germany, nobody cared. And now nobody cares about Africa. We don't care. It's not us. We're not being gored. And so that's a tragedy happening every day. But the challenge of that happening was God. Was God. How do you take God after such a horrible thing happened? How do you maintain any kind of a faith at all when such a horrible thing happened? I shared in the talk back yesterday that in my own image of God, my own conception of God, and I'm not going to get there deeply today, I don't think, but in my own conception of God, I can't help but think that if God could have intervened and didn't, why do I want to have that God? Why do I want to pray to that God? Why do I want to hold on to that God? What good is that God if God could sit back and say, let it be? I don't think it's God's responsibility, but it's going to take me a full day to get there. And we're going to start today. So we're going to. Here's where I get into trouble with UUs all the time. We're going to get into God language, folks. Now, I did notice that one of your songs had God in it. That was really kind of exciting for me this morning. Oh, my God, there's God. I know that word, G-O-D. Yeah, I see it, you know. Kind of neat. I was waiting for somebody to throw oranges and tomatoes, but, you know, you got through it well. I was really proud of you. Oh, my gosh. Throughout history, we have held concepts of God. Now, understand that a concept has no basis in reality. We all have concepts of God, every one of us. Even those who do not believe in God have a concept of God in which they do not believe. And we struggle, I think, some of us, with that realization that all we know nothing about God. We can write lots of words. Maimonides wrote in his book called The Guide to the Perplexed, which is perplexing as hell. It really is. That's a horrible work to read. It was written originally actually in Arabic because he didn't want Jews to read it because he was afraid it would take Jews away from traditional Judaism, and he would. It has been translated into Hebrew now, and there's a Hebrew translation of it, which is impossible Hebrew. And then there was an English translation that came out with a guy by, and I don't make these things up, the guy had the unlikely name of Penis. You know, that was his name. And he wrote like his name. Really difficult book to read in English, you know. But in my class on Maimonides, my professor used to be fond of saying, so, gentlemen, and in those days it was all gentlemen. Women didn't come into my seminary until probably around 1968 or so. Yeah, about that. And so he would look and he'd say, so, gentlemen, did you bring your penis to class today? You know. Maybe. But he did write in his Guide to the Perplexed that we could say nothing positive about God. We could say what God isn't, but we couldn't say what God is. So God is not this, God is not that, God is not a man, God is not a woman. I go down the list. But to be able to say God is, he thought was impossible as a philosopher. Having said that, I'm going to try to give you different God concepts that people say God is. And it starts It starts with the Bible. A line is attributed to Karl Barth, but it may have been from Madeleine L'Engle in a book called A Stone for a Pillar, and it's still used today, and it's now even the title of a book. And in one of your worships, you mentioned that book. But the phrase that they say Barth may have given was, "Yes, indeed, I take the Bible too seriously to take it all literally." I think we have a choice. We can either take the Bible seriously or we can take it literally. I don't think we can do both. I don't think that's possible. Because I don't even know what taking it literally means. In most of America, those who tell us we have to take it literally honestly believe that the Bible was written in the King James Version. The idea that it may have been in another language is totally foreign to them. Every now and then when I'm feeling feisty and I get some missionaries at my door, I invite them in. And we talk about what they think the Bible says, you know, and I've certainly not converted any of them to Judaism. My wife looks at me and says, "Why are you even taking the time to do that?" And I say, "Because it's fun." I mean, you know. So everybody's got to have a little recreation every now and then. Right now in our neighborhood, it's mostly Jehovah's Witnesses, and I have great contempt. I must tell you, I have little patience because of my experience with them in the LGBT community, and they really shun something awful of gay people and trans people. But that's an aside. But now I don't do that with them anymore. I just say, "No, I'm Jewish," and they don't know what to say. And honestly, you say, "I'm Jew." Okay, you know. At least other Christians give you a Bible. They give you a watchtower. And it's just not the same. But we all have those concepts, and it starts with the Bible. And I'm going to go through kind of briefly what I see as different conceptions of God that appear in the Hebrew Scripture. And the first comes in Genesis. God is very human in Genesis. God is a person. He walks, he talks, he walks through the Garden of Eden. He's the creator God. That's his purpose. That's his only purpose, is really to be a creator God. He is the God that brings a universe into being. In the beginning, let there be light, and there was light, and the universe came into being. And then human beings ultimately came into the picture as the creation of God in God's own image. Now, what does that mean? Is it man-like? Is it woman-like? Is it human-like? Well, probably, but it also has a different meaning to it, is that ability to choose, that ability to be discerning is a human quality, and that also comes from the image of God in this Genesis picture. So, God is very much a person in Genesis. And yesterday in the talk back, we got into some theology in the talk back. I'd like to promise that won't happen again, but it's better than politics. Only marginally, at least with the UUs. We were talking yesterday, and I was using God in that kind of an image, and they said, "Well, do you believe in that God?" And I said, "It doesn't make any difference. The biblical author of Genesis believed in that God. That's the author's conception that he's giving to us." And so, you know, that is the God that's there. And that God works reasonably well until the exodus from Egypt. Because in the exodus from Egypt, we now have a different God concept that develops. Now God is a tribal chief. God is the leader of a nomadic people. There are human leaders, as Moses and Aaron, and, you know, they're going to bring the people, a two-day walk takes them 40 years. It's really kind of an interesting sort of a story. But, in fact, if depending on where in Egypt you are, it could be over the line. But they wander around, and they're a nomadic people, and God is a nomadic chieftain. So when Moses and Aaron get into any kind of trouble, where do they go? They go to the tent of meeting. They go to speak to God and say, hey, God, what should we do about this? Hey, God, what should we do with that? These people are awful. They're murmuring. They're complaining. They don't like new facilities that we have in the middle of the desert here. And they're butching around about all these things and manna and no meat and we'd be better off and so they go to God. And what is God's purpose there? If the Genesis God is creation, the Exodus God is leading the flock to the land flowing with milk and honey. Any good nomadic leader is trying to find the grazing grounds, is trying to find the good land to have. And this is, I think, the God that develops in Exodus, the tribal chieftain God. He has a home, but it's a home in a tent. It's the tent of meeting. And so they schlep that tent around with them, and they set it up, and there's a cloud by day and a fire by night to show whether God's home or night. And during the wanderings, the fire and the cloud lift so they can schlep it to another location, because God's a nomad. God goes with you. God's everywhere. And that works reasonably well until they get into the land. When they get into the land of Canaan, and they settle down, and then, you know, they decide they want a king, which was probably one of the great mistakes of Jewish history. And God warns them, don't do that. But they want a king anyhow. And David becomes king. And David's living in a palace. And David, I found out yesterday in my workshop, is Gregory Peck. I didn't know that. So we saw a little clip from, I'm sorry, not David. Samson. Samson. Was it Samson who was? No, it was David. It was David and Bathsheba, but not Gregory Peck. Who was it? Well, I think it was. Yeah. Anyway, I thought it was a funny clip from there because he's wearing this big Star of David on his chest, and that symbol didn't come into being until probably the 19th century. But hey, you know, what the heck? You know, it's fine. In any case, how do I let myself get into this? In any case, it is really embarrassing for your God to be living in a tent when your king lives in a palace. So you need to build a palace for your God, and you call it a temple. That's what temples are. They're palaces for God. And I know I talked about that, the inner sanctum, the outer sanctum, the kingly role. But now the vision of God totally changes. God is no longer a nomadic chief. God is the King of Kings. The Holy One, praise be God. The King of Kings. Majestic. All-knowing. Powerful. Brings crops at the right time, dew at the right time, rain at the right time. Agriculturally based. You visit God as you visit a king, a royal. You bring gifts to God. You worship God as the King of Kings. And I've got to tell you, in our liturgy, we still have references to that. There's a prayer which in English we call the Adoration. In Hebrew we call it the Aleinu. And at one point we refer in that prayer to the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be God. Actually, it says blessed be Him, but nobody cares anymore. A word of Hebrew I want to tell you. This, again, an aside. The Hebrew word Adonai means Lord. That's what it means. And it's substituted for the name of God. In the talk back, we had a little bit of that yesterday. I'm not going to do that again today. So if you want to get back into that, come to the talk back or beer. Take your choice. But in any case, Adonai was substituted, and instead of blessed are you, the name, okay, the name here, became blessed are you, Adonai, Baruch Atah Adonai, Elohim, blessed are you, my Lord. Okay, very good. Well, we can't use Lord anymore in our worship. Lord is out. Lord is out because it's a masculine term, and we have now gone to gender-neutral language. And incidentally, I think that's a good thing. I'm not complaining about that, except that I've had real trouble with Lord. I can get by, you know, other references to male, but Lord, I struggle with. But I get it sometimes. Anyway, we can't use Lord anymore. So what did they do? In all of their wisdom, in all of their collective rabbinic thought, in all of their excitement to get rid of sexist language, in English, they changed it to, blessed are you, Adonai. Means my Lord. As long as nobody knows that, it's fine. Yeah. It's incredible. And they got away with it. but, But this King of King notion carried on well beyond the destruction of the temple in a concept of this majestic being that is all powerful. But then the exile comes, and I'm going to just briefly mention this because we talked about it in the terms of exile. The exile comes, and if your God's in a temple in Jerusalem and you're in Babylon, it's not a good thing. It really is not a good thing. And so while you yearn to go back, you've got to do something, and now God changes entirely when you get the God of the prophets. Now the God of the prophets go with you. God is now a puppeteer. God is controlling history. God is in charge of what's happening. And we're going to come back to the idea of whether Jews at that point in history really believed that there was only one God or not. But in any case, that's unimportant. The God that they had was this God that controlled history. If Israel was bad, bring in the enemy. If Israel was good, wipe out the enemy. It all revolved around Israel, however. The entire history of this period and God's relationship with human beings always revolved around Israel. Why? Because we wrote the damn book, okay? I mean, you know, we weren't going to give credit to others for that. So it all revolved around Israel and Israel. And I'm not talking about the land Israel. I'm talking about the people Israel, the children of Israel, that family that came out of the desert. It all revolved about what Israel needed or how Israel was behaving and whether Israel was being faithful. But that's the God of the prophets. And then the last God comes along, the post-prophetic God, Big Daddy, the heavenly bellhop. For most of us, that's still God today, okay? And for most people who reject the concept of God, that's the concept they're rejecting, the concept of Big Daddy, the heavenly bellhop. Ring my bell, tell me what you want. Dear God, bring me a new Maserati. Dear God, I need this. Dear God, I need that. I have to make a decision. I'm going to go pray on it because God will tell me which way to go. All of these kinds of uses of God as our servant, no longer the king, now God's our servant. And I can't help but think that if God needs our advice, God is in such big trouble I don't know what the future of the world would be. Because somehow we truly believe that we are so important in a vast universe that God has nothing else to do but wait for David to ring his bell and say, here's what you should do, God. And so I understand that that's a hard concept for a lot of people to maintain, although obviously a lot of people still do. And I think that has really carried over, and it's really carried over into Judaism as well. I don't want to be glib about this because our prayer book has all sorts of petitionary prayers that are in there. But interestingly enough, not on the Sabbath. We don't have petitionary prayers on the Sabbath. We don't ask God for anything on the Sabbath. 6 days you shall labor, God rested on the seventh. Leave God alone 1 day a week. It's all right. But other than that, we have petitionary prayer, and it's there. And I struggle with it. I do. I do it, but I struggle with it. And I struggle with it precisely because I don't think that that's God's role in our lives. It's not a concept I'm comfortable with. But I think it's still the primary concept today that comes in that post-prophetic period. So we have lots of changes. And the question becomes, how seriously did the ancient Israels... how seriously are we going to end this on time? And we're going to end this on time by saying, Big Daddy the heavenly bellhop, come back tomorrow for the continuing tale. And now we have to add 2 more days to the week. L'chulu shalom. Go to peace.